best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, seahorses are some of the most unique and beautiful creatures in the ocean. The pygmy seahorse is one of the most interesting looking and complex of them all. Due to their small size, they were not known to exist until about 50 years ago. We will learn all about this tiny creature that comes from the depths of the ocean that hides in coral. You're listening to the best of our knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. A species of seahorse was only discovered about 50 years ago due to their tiny size. Try to guess the size. Only 1 inch. The pygmy seahorse is considered one of the tiniest species of seahorse. Yet, what they lack in size, they pack a punch once it comes to their characteristics and complexity. This creature lives in coral and over time has adapted to look just like it. It's the perfect disguise. Over time, their evolutionary process has caused them to both lose and gain genes, attributing changes to them physically and internally. I spoke with Axel Meyer, a professor of evolutionary biology and zoology at the University of Constance, to learn more.
Oh, they're the cutest little things. They're only 2 centimeters, so less than 1 inch in size. That actually makes them one of the smallest vertebrate species. They look, for me, they are an example of the sort of the exuberance of fantasy of evolution. They look like the corals they live in. They have a short snout. They have sort of bulbous protuberances on their skin. And they match the color and the structure of the corals that they live in. So they're very hard to spot. They were only discovered about 50 years ago.
So I'm glad you mentioned the bumps, because when I was looking at pictures of this species, I was fascinated by it. Because like you said, they kind of look like the coral, the environment that they live in. So I was wondering if those bumps serve them any purpose, and describe them a little bit more, and if they do anything for the seahorse in any way.
So seahorses are obviously very unusual fish, right? So they have lost the caudal fin, the tail fin. They have lost the pelvic fins. Those are the paired fins in the sort of where our hips are, the hind limbs. And they don't move around very much at all. They have the prehensile tail like a monkey, which they use to hold on to corals. And they have a very passive lifestyle. So they're waiting for the food to come by and pick up little crustaceans or larvae that swim by. But the name of the game for them is to be conspicuous, to be camouflaged, to look like the background that they're sitting on so that the predators cannot find them and eat them. And so these protuberances and the color match the background of the coral. And these protuberances on the skin of these tiny seahorses look sort of like the polyps of a coral.
So could you describe the coral a little bit more? What specific coral do they live in or on? And if you could just describe what that coral looks like as well.
As far as I know, there are 6 species of pygmy seahorses described, and they differ a little bit in their size and coloration. Some of them are more yellowish. Others, this one is very pink. It looks sort of like, what's that movie called? Barbie. Where everything is pink. They look like that. And their coral that they live on also has this color. It has a structure. I mean, corals can have very many different shapes and sizes and so on. Some look like rocks and some look like sort of the deer, antlers of a deer. These are sort of a little bit fragile looking like, oh, I don't know if anything else that looks like it, but they sort of look like tiny pencil thick little structures and twigs, and these pygmy seahorses hide between these tiny branches of the coral.
So something that really caught my attention in the research article when I was reading it is that the pygmy seahorse kind of flips the role of the sexes in mating. So I would love for you to explain that for all of us.
Right. Yeah, seahorses are a very unusual fish. I mean, not only the way they look by losing the tail, they have sort of a bony armament around them. They have spikes, or in this case, protuberances. But the reason I'm interested in them is because they're unusual. They have this unusual lifestyle where they have something called sex role reversal. In this group of fish, in all seahorses, it's like this, where the male evolved a brood pouch. It's sort of like in the female kangaroo, a pouch in which the eggs by the females are laid, and the male protects them in his pouch and broods them. That means he actually provides them, depending on the species, but he actually provides these eggs and developing embryos with oxygen and nutrient, like a mammalian placenta. And so the male really behaves like a female. And the sex role reversal goes so far that in almost all species, the males compete for access to females. This is a very fundamental evolutionary principle, and it has to do with the fact that males are defined by producing the smaller gametes, sperm, and sperm is cheap compared to eggs, because in eggs, you invest more energy. Eggs are larger, and particularly in birds, where the eggs are really large, or in mammals, where the female takes care of a single baby in the case of humans, or in some species of mammals, maybe if you have a cat or a dog, I don't know, they have six, eight, or even 10 babies, but a limited number. So a limited number of eggs. And so that means the females are the limiting resource in almost all species. Males compete for access and the privilege to fertilize her eggs. Here, the sex roles are reversed so that in some species, actually, the females are competing for access to males because the limiting resource is not, as in many other species, the eggs, but rather the size of the pouch of the male. How many eggs will fit inside the pouch of the male? And he can be choosy. So he can select one female over another based on size or coloration. And in some species, it's actually the females that are beautifully colored. Think of songbirds. And songbirds, almost the males are always beautifully colored. And they are competing with each other by singing, by defending the territory, but they're also courting for the female. And in the seahorses, it's the other way around. The females court for the males. So that makes it very unusual and very interesting to study.
I would like to know, how do these specific seahorses, the pygmy seahorses, differ from other species of seahorses? Because we know there's many of them, right? So I'm wondering what those differences are.
So we have worked on many different seahorses. Like I said, we've been interested in the evolution of this pouch because in different species, the pouch is sometimes more simple and sometimes more complicated. And we were interested based on evolutionary trees that reflect the evolutionary relationships of species to sort of map on this tree the evolution of the complexity of the pouch. The seahorse, so we have worked on other seahorses, normal seahorses in quotation marks, but also a sea dragon, which is a very unusual fish. The pygmy seahorses, it turns out, are the deepest branch in the tree of seahorses. So they're the from the ancestor of all seahorses. The first branch to branch off are the pygmy seahorses. I'm not quite sure what this means. We're not sure if this means that they early on became smaller and smaller in their size compared to other seahorses. Some of them can be quite large. The sea dragons can almost be a foot long, for example. But they all tend to have this more passive lifestyle. They hide among corals. They have a small number of babies, which also means that they cannot sort of broadcast the eggs into the ocean, but rather the lifestyle, the life history of seahorses is such that the males give, like I said, take on the eggs of the females, and then they incubate them for many days, and then they release miniature seahorses from their pouch. So they are already independent little seahorses, but that also means that they cannot disperse very far because a little seahorse would be easily eaten very quickly if they're not hiding in the coral reef. Or in kelp beds or some other parts of the ocean. So seahorses unites that they're all very, very small. They live relatively deep in the ocean. I mean, not super deep, but deeper than most species of seahorses. That tend to be some of them tend to be in kelp beds close to the shore, only a few meters of water. Pygmy seahorses sometimes live quite deeper. Another reason for why they were discovered so late. But so apparently they found their very specific lifestyle of miniaturization, of hiding in these corals, and again living in this symbiotic commensal relationship with the coral, because they also change their genes very much based on the habitat. You know, corals live by stunning prey that they catch out of the water, and so they're poisonous. The seahorses are not affected by this, but rather they probably even utilized the antibiotic or other chemical characteristics of the poison of the coral to their advantage, so that they could actually lose quite a few immune genes. So they, it turns out, we sequenced the genome of these small, beautiful animals. They have one of the smallest genome in terms of number of genes in the immune system, for example. And we think this is possible as a response to living, being protected by the coral.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. If you're just joining us, we're learning all about pygmy seahorses with Axel Meyer, a professor of evolutionary biology and zoology at the University of Konstanz in Germany.
How did you conduct your study to research further into the genes and evolution of the pygmy seahorse?
So there's a long history of my laboratory in Konstanz working with this lab in Guangzhou. And our interests converged over the years, so that some research ideas are developed by us, or when we design a project, we talk on Zoom like now, and we discuss how can we explain this particular feature of the body or the biology of the organism. Because today it's relatively simple to sequence a genome, to sequence the entirety of all the genes of a particular organism. But it's a long way away from going from this genome, from this genetic information, to making prediction what the animal actually looks like. And we have been trying to do this in different kinds of studies. And the way you do this, the first paper we published with this group in Guangzhou was published in 2016, where we sequenced a normal, in quotation marks, seahorse. And there we noticed, for example, that a particular gene, TBX4, that's a gene that's expressed in the developing embryo of all vertebrates, in the place of the hip, where the hind limbs form. And we notice that the genome of this seahorse doesn't have this gene. So we suspect that maybe the loss, the absence of this gene, is part of the explanation for why they lost these fins. And so, how do you actually prove this? These days, you make a CRISPR fish. And that means you knock out this gene, you destroy the function of this gene, and hope that the embryo will develop normally otherwise, and look what this fish looks like. And so we did this with the zebra fish, and lo and behold, the zebra fish, where we knocked out this particular gene, did not have these fins, just like a seahorse. And this is sort of the one way by which you can test your suspicions or your signals that you seem to find in the genome to say, yes, this is actually the cause for what I see in the biology of the organism. And so, for the bumps, you can, for example, look at what genes are switched on, and you can sort of genes that make fibers in the body. And these, if you look at the histology, if you look at the structure of the cells or the arrangement of the cells in these bumps, that makes perfect sense. Or you can do studies where you show where a gene is switched on in the body of an organism by attaching a bioluminescent marker to this. And so you can look at the organism where you mark this particular gene and then see where does it light up. And so there are different kinds of technical approaches by which you can sort of narrow down suspected functions of genes and thereby close the gap between genes and the external biology of an organism.
So, in your results, what I read, it was evident that the pygmy seahorse over time lost DNA as well as genes. So, how much was lost, and what was the effect on the species? I mean, and what did they lose over that period of time?
Right. You would think that if evolution invents something new, you would think that this is due to maybe the evolution of a new gene for something. But in this case, and more generally, there are more and more studies that suggest actually losing genes sometimes sort of frees up the organism to evolve something new. And this is because during the development from a fertilized egg to a fish or pig or human, the genes talk to each other and bring about the shape of the embryo, for example, the vertebrae column, like I said, the limbs in the front and the hind limbs and so on. These are actually quite conservative developmental mechanisms that are caused by the same set, if it's a pig or a bat or an elephant or a fish, where apparently in evolution, something very fundamental was laid down hundreds of millions of years ago. And sometimes losing one of these genes that is in a constrained network of interactions might lose up a developmental cascade or mechanism to make something new. And so we think part of the explanation for some of the novelties that we find. So, for example, the fact that they have a short snout, which is a good thing if you want to look like a polyp of a coral. But that's unusual because all seahorses have a horse-like head. That's why they're called seahorses, because they have this very long snout. But when they are young, embryonic fish, they have more, seahorses look more like a normal, in quotation marks, fish and have a short snout. And so we had the idea that maybe these seahorses have short snouts because they sort of arrested in a juvenile developmental stage. So if you think of a puppy or a young cat, they have short snouts, right? They look so cute. And then they grow out to have a longer nose of whatever, a poodle or a German shepherd or something. All dogs go through the stage of having a short snout when they're small, when they're young. But depending on the which kind of dog you're talking about, they grow longer or shorter snouts. And so we had the idea, maybe the pygmy seahorses sort of arrested development. They don't grow past their juvenile stage. And so we proved this through a number of comparisons. We compared the growth of small pygmy seahorses to normal seahorses and looked how quickly the snout was growing in relation to the rest of the body. And so we could show that the snout is sort of growing much more slowly than a comparative species of seahorses. So this is one of the approaches. And I already mentioned losing many genes in the immune system, which was possible presumably because they live in this very specialized environment. So there are several examples where we noticed, oh, these fish lost genes or the gene families. Often gene families, they're called families because they have cousins and uncles and aunts. So you have a number of genes that are closely related. And we noticed that these family trees of particular genes in seahorses are smaller than in other species of fish. So they lost some genes secondarily that are present in almost all other fishes. So they simplified their genetic material, if you will, but not to their disadvantage. I mean, of course, having this very specialized lifestyle, in essence, mandates that they would only be possible for them to live on the corals, that the corals went extinct. And this is, of course, a worry through ocean acidification or ocean warming. You know about coral bleaching that happens, unfortunately, in many places around the world. And the corals bleach because the algae that live symbiotically with the corals die and they leave the corals and then they are no longer green. They can no longer photosynthesize and so on. And this would, of course, be devastating for the pygmy seahorse because if their host coral would be white rather than pink, they would stick out and then they would be easily picked up by their predators. So, in any event, so this extreme adaptation and very specialized lifestyle makes them safe in their particular environment, but it might make them more vulnerable to many environmental perturbations.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. I've been speaking with Axel Meyer, a professor of evolutionary biology and zoology at the University of Konstanz in Germany, all about pygmy seahorses, to learn more.
So, you mentioned before that actually gene losses can actually be beneficial for the pygmy seahorse, or hasn't really been a disadvantage to the species. And you mentioned the immune system, which caught my eye, because I would think if you lose genes in the immune system, that might cripple you. But actually, maybe it didn't. So I'd love for you to kind of explain that for us.
Right. So in general, you would assume that any piece of DNA that you have to have a copy of in each of your cells is associated with the cost, right? Because you have to make the A's, G's, T's, and C's that make up our genome. So you would think that there might be selection pressure to make genomes particularly small and compact because there is a cost associated with that. And so that may be one possible explanation for why it is advantageous to lose genes that don't serve a purpose for you anymore. Your ancestors had it. We know that from comparison of other species. But in the lifestyle you now have, and this may be a cul-de-sac, this may be detrimental in the end to the pygmy seahorse, be tied to the coral. But because the coral protect them through the poison and through their structure, I mean, the pygmy seahorses hide between the branches of the coral, you might be able to afford to lose some genes. And you don't need the immune system. I mean, the immune system in seahorses is simpler to begin with because this probably has to do with the male pregnancy. I mean, as a woman, you know this. If you have an embryo in you, the embryo only has 50% of your gene variants and the other 50% of the father. And so your fetus is genetically identical to you. And the fetus has different interests from you. It wants more nutrition from your placenta to grow faster, but it may not be an interest of the mammal mother that has a placenta. Also, there is this tug of war in terms of the immune system. As you know, many pregnancies in humans get lost at pregnancy. And this can be due to many reasons, but it could be due to the misfit of the immune system of the embryo to the mother's immune system. For example, morning sickness is a signal that the immune system has to arrange itself with the embryo. It wants to raise it, but essentially, it's raising a genetic alien inside of it. I'm sort of exacerbating this a little bit. But so we had this publication where we suggested that the male pregnancy is also an explanation for why the immune system was reduced already in seahorses and much more than in the pygmy seahorse due to the fact that the embryo lives so closely associated with oxygen, nutrients, and so on, that the male needs to try to prevent the rejection of the eggs and of the developing embryo inside his pouch. And so we knew before that the immune system of all seahorses is simplified compared to the ancestor. But here it's particularly small and reduced. The immune system has a very small number of genes. The pouch of the pygmy seahorse is a little bit different from other seahorse pouches in that it sort of goes really inside the body cavity. Also because they're so tiny, they only have a very, very small number of embryos, maybe 10 or less, that they can brood inside the pouch and then give birth to. In any event, we think that this is part of the explanation for why the immune system could afford to become so small, or maybe was forced to become so small due to this very intimate relationship of the embryo with the animal and of the relationship of the fish, the pygmy seahorse, with the coral.
What did you find the most fascinating about this research for you? What did you find the most fascinating about it all?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I've never thought about this. Like I said, I'm driven by just trying to understand the world around me a little bit better. And research that was not intended to be done with a purpose of developing medicines or being of human use in any other way. This was simply to try to understand the world around us a little bit better. I mean, anybody who's seen a picture, a photograph of these fish will agree that these are really, really odd, beautiful, strange creatures. And I think there's something to be explained about this. all the aspects that we were trying to explain, like the tubercles, the snout, the immune system, all of them are sort of part of the package of what makes this fish a pygmy seahorse. I mean, obviously, we didn't explain everything. I mean, we don't know too much about the color yet. As I said in the beginning of our conversation, some of them are yellow and some of them are pink, different species. It would be fascinating to know if there's sort of a polymorphism in the different species, and some are yellow and some are pink. And then you can ask yourself, how does the fish know it's pink and it lives on a pink coral? Can they look at their fins and decide, oh, I'm pink, I'm going to settle on a pink coral? There are many things we don't have an answer to. And compared to when I was a student, now I think we have all the tools in terms of genomics or CRISPR that I mentioned before, other sort of molecular biology tools that we can use. 30, 40 years ago, we couldn't dream of course, right? So we're making progress with understanding the world around us a little bit better. And I'm just hoping that we can understand it better before it goes extinct. Because in my lifetime as a scientist, I not only work on seahorses, but also on particular fish in Africa and Nicaragua. And I've traveled to the same places catching fish for 30 or 40 years, and I've seen how the environment was changed by human impact through agriculture or some other form of destroying our environment. And so pygmy seahorses are sort of a gift of nature, a gift of evolution, something so cute and unusual to look at and to try to understand a little bit better. I would be hard pressed to say what I like, what I find most fascinating of our study. I think we might continue with some of the work. I mean, these animals are very hard to keep in the laboratory. It's virtually impossible to breed them in the laboratory. So you're limited by what kind of things you can do with them to understand them better. I mean, everybody studies zebrafish because you can breed them easily. The eggs are translucent and so on. So there are many reasons for so-called model systems. And model systems simply mean you can study them in the lab easily, a mouse or a zebrafish or what have you. But these are definitely not model systems. They are very hard to keep in the lab. Seahorses in general are not easy to keep in the lab. We had some in my laboratory, and when they become free swimming after they leave the father's pouch, they switch to a different diet, and it's hard to have the right food for them as they grow up and so on. In any event, I'm happy to understand the world a little bit better, and I'm happy if people around the world might look at these fish and think, oh yeah, how cute that is, and maybe we now know a little bit more about it.
That was Axel Meyer, a professor of evolutionary biology and zoology at the University of Konstanz in Germany. His research was originally published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1827. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.